This is Our Voice, Politics Albury Wodonga, and you're with Ben Habib. In this instalment of the podcast, Our Voice's Sophie Buckle discusses modern-day India with Dr. Yamini Narayanan. Yamini is a lecturer in the School of Social Sciences at La Trobe University in Melbourne. Her research interests include urban sustainability, women and development, and climate change adaptation. In this discussion, Yamini and Sophie used the recent Delhi Commonwealth Games as a case study to examine contemporary Indian society. I hope that you enjoy Dr. Yamini Narayanan in conversation with Sophie Buckle.
Yamini, since you grew up in India, I was interested in why you moved to Australia and whether you've considered moving back to India.
Wow, that's a really interesting question in a way. Well, I left India when I was 23. For a lot of Indians, actually, studying abroad is the Indian equivalent of backpacking, because it's very difficult for Indians to actually get a visa, a tourist visa, which actually allows them to go from country after country. So when we get to that age where we think we want to see the world, we end up studying abroad because we just don't have the same opportunity to travel because the Indian passport doesn't allow us to, you know, get the visas everywhere. And I was actually headed to the United States. And at that time, the Iraq War happened and, you know, things turned a bit crazy in Iraq, in America. People of Indian origin were getting targeted and et cetera, because they thought they were all part of, you know, the wild Asian community. So I ended up coming to Australia. But my other reason for coming to Australia, really, I think a deeper reason was actually because I wanted to go to a place where there were very few Indians at that time. Well, I just wanted a clean break, you know. And I ended up in Perth. I mean, when I went to Perth, I mean, Perth wasn't planned. I was actually thinking of coming to either Melbourne or Sydney, but the way things turned out, I ended up getting a full scholarship in Perth. So I went to Perth, and I was literally the only Indian for miles and miles at that time in 2003. I felt like Mother India walking into Perth, you know.
So, which would have been different if it was Melbourne.
Probably would have been different if it was Melbourne. But even I think Australia comparatively had far fewer Indians. But it wasn't just India that I wanted to take a clean break from. It was also Tamilian Brahmin Indians. You know, that was my caste that I come from. And, you know, people were trying to, yo, you must go marry this kind of fellow. And, you know, there was all this matchmaking happening at that time. And about 90% of the Indian Brahmin boys actually live in the United States, not in India. 90% of them. So I thought, I'm going to America from India was like stepping from the frying pan into the fire. So I thought, let's go to a place where there are no Indians. Not that I had anything against Indians. I, you know, if there comes a time when you think you want a break. And traveling was not an option, so I thought, studying is an option. I didn't expect that I would end up staying, but yeah, that happened. Yeah.
Very good. Okay, for this interview, we're going to use the case study of the 2010 Delhi Commonwealth Games to explore issues relating to contemporary India.
Yeah.
So just for a first question, a big issue that surrounded the Games was security.
Mm-hmm.
And India has had terrorist attacks in the past, and the media seemed to claw onto the idea that the Games were almost a breeding ground for more terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that these were credible claims by the media?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think these were absolutely credible claims because the Commonwealth Games is definitely any high-profile event, any high-profile international event that's held in India is definitely a magnet and a target for terrorist activities, in my view. It's always been the case, no matter which major international event has taken place in India, whether these are major conferences, UN summits, even Miss World. Cricket matches, for example, they're a great example of how international profile events, even when Pakistan is not playing, even if it is Australia and India, or even if it is Sri Lanka and India, these are all international events of this sort, where there's a lot of attention and where there's a lot of crowd coming in, are definitely opportunities and magnets for terrorist activities to occur, I think. So I think that these are credible claims. But at the same time, what the government was trying to do with the Commonwealth Games was also what India is trying to do is actually eventually be in a position to bid for the Olympic Games. Now, being a major sports superpower nation is important for any country that aspires to be a superpower. If you think about it all, you know, that was one of China's strategies too. One of the first things that China did to announce itself as a superpower was to host the Olympic Games. And that's what India eventually wants to do. Like every major important country in the world has got a very strong sports base. You know, America does, Australia does, most European nations do. All the wealthy, powerful nations. Sports is almost a symbol of, you know, power, authority, visibility, you know, prowess, the capacity to govern, the capacity to lead. All of these things are things that actually sports represent. So the government is really is trying very hard to eventually, they're using the Commonwealth Games to bid for the Olympics in the future, which is possible that they will, because in the end, the games did run successfully. In fact, they were the most expensive games. The security threats, they showed the capacity to manage them because there weren't any security threats in the end. The athletes were safe. Though, of course, there was all the publicity leading right onto it with the bad publicity around hygiene and security, etc. But a lot of that also, I think, has to do with Indian psychology. You know, where you think things are going to go bad and then they all, you know, turn out well in the end.
You mentioned about India and Pakistan. Do you think that Pakistan would be jealous of India hosting the Commonwealth Games?
The India-Pakistan psychology is a really, really interesting one, actually. There is a very, very strong unacknowledged sense in Pakistan, from what I hear and from what I've read, of India's... you know, it's unacknowledged largely that India has actually done much better since partition than Pakistan. These are questions that are not raised in the Urdu press, in the vernacular local press, because that would actually create some sense of riots, really. But in the English language press, where, you know, the scholarly communities tends to congregate more, these kind of questions are being raised about, you know, what have we got from partition, like, Would it actually have been better for us to have stayed as one country? So these are questions that have been repeatedly been asked in the intellectual circles in Pakistan for quite some time now. Commonwealth Games is one latest event, but I think this kind of the questioning around whether it was actually a wise decision to separate from Pakistan, from India, have we actually got much out of it, have been questions that have been raised for quite a long time, though not in the Urdu press, not in the press where most of the citizens actually have access to.
Yeah. And you mentioned also about the threats and the health problems, like that there weren't any. There's a lot of work and preparation that goes into hosting the Commonwealth Games. And there were some issues brought to, like, again, by the media brought to light about, like, official corruptions and the facilities not being complete in time for the events. How does that impact upon the Games and what does it reflect of India?
Very contradictory reflections, I would say, on one hand, because the view of a lot of athletes, including many Indian athletes, was that the facilities that were ultimately provided to the athletes surpassed their experience of facilities elsewhere. It was almost 10 star, you know, so the facilities that were actually put into place for the athletes in the end, they were absolutely deluxe. So they were really, really of a very, very high standard and quality that happened in the end. Right up to the games, though, all those pictures you saw with you know, the dirty toilets, etc., they were all true and authentic pictures. That was also the case. Okay, and that's a really good reflection of money being siphoned off elsewhere instead of being directed to what it is meant to do. Now, the impact that it had on the games... The games itself, from what I know, went off fairly smoothly, but I think the impact was longer term on the government's capacity. You know, those were the kind of questions that it raised. I think the government's credibility in being actually able to deliver an event painlessly. You know, does it have the organization and leadership capacity to do that? Can they afford the sort of publicity with the Commonwealth Games? Now, again, the Commonwealth Games in itself, though, is not very different from other high-profile events that India has hosted. Like, for example, the city of Agra, which is only about 4 hours from Delhi. Agra is where the Taj Mahal is. Now, that's a, you know, that should be the Venice of India. That should be a honeymoon destination because the Taj Mahal is a monument of love, etc., right? The dead emperor built it for, I mean, the emperor built it for his dead wife.
Mm-hmm.
Monument of love, it should, and the river flows through it. It's a beautiful, it could be an extraordinarily beautiful city. Now, each time there's an international political summit, for example, like the US president comes or the Pakistani president comes, they typically tend to meet at the Taj, at Agra. Now, each time a head of state comes, millions of dollars is poured into the city to clean it up. Within 6 months, it becomes dirty again.
Yeah.
Okay? So, like, for example, 1 year I remember, I think it was in 2002, the US president as well as the Pakistani president came within months of each other. And within months of each other, the same amount of money was poured in. Because the capacity to sustain what they actually put in was just not there. So I think all the money that's been poured into Delhi, into beautifying Delhi, into upgrading the airports, into upgrading the roads, will the government and successive governments after it have the capacity to maintain the infrastructure, to maintain all that money that's been poured into it? Because Delhi as the national capital, we can expect more and more of these events to be hosted there. The Olympic Games, if it happens, will be hosted in Delhi again. You know, but how much of all this work will have to be done again, bottom up?
Mm.
You know, because there's an investment each time money is that much money is put in, somebody benefits. Mm. Somebody actually benefits from that sort of money being put in each time. Whereas, you know, the capacity to just sustain what you've already put in requires less money.
And is it almost a waste of money to spend all that money on people that are just for a massive event rather than citizens that spend their whole lives in India and don't get that money?
You have raised a really important point here, an absolutely valid and one of the most important questions that urban planners face or have an argument against all the time, saying that event-specific city planning is a bad idea. You know, because all the upgrading that's happened to Delhi at the moment has been around the Commonwealth Games, and that's event-specific. Because history has generally shown, or research has shown, that when the event is over, then the planning doesn't necessarily have the capacity to sustain itself because it is not kept in mind the long-term interest, but rather the short-term interest. Right? So event-specific urban planning is always a problem. And most cities have actually, you know, made that mistake of having event-specific urban planning. But Delhi has again done that. And as you said, I mean, Delhi did the same thing, you know, try and push the poor away, relocate them for the time of the games. They weren't allowed to be in the city, you know, making it seem like a wealthy city. So, yeah, definitely, it's not a democratic way of planning. Urban planning, which is event-specific, is not democratic because it's planned around the events that people are going to benefit from.
Another thing that was seen while the games were actually on was if you watched an event, you could see that there wasn't a huge crowd attendance. Mm. And I read a report yesterday that spoke about how that a lot of tickets were trying to be given away to even students or children.
Mm.
What would be a reason why there wasn't as many people attending, both locally but also international visitors?
That's again a really good question. I'm very glad you asked that question. See, when China hosted its Commonwealth Games, China was actually already pretty established as a sports power. You know, they had already been winning medals elsewhere. They'd already been winning medals at the previous Olympics, at the previous major sports events, you know. So China was already on the scene. China didn't arrive with the Olympic Games. In a way, India's trying to arrive with the event rather than with the talent. I mean, India has the infrastructure, you know, provided, you know, aside from all the corruption, India actually does have both the human resources as well as, you know, all the money to actually be able to host that sort of games. But China or additionally had a really large talented pool of international athletes, which India didn't have. India's major claim to sports has always been cricket. You know, India has never actually shone in any other sports before. That said, India took away the second largest number of medals, which again reflects its aspirations to be a sports superpower. So after Australia, India took the second largest pool of medals. But at the same time, the reason why there was actually, you know, such a low attendance in the audience was because Indians are typically only attached to sport, to cricket. So if there's swimming or if there's tennis, I mean, the emotional attachment is not there. So the audience is there. You know, you have an audience when they have an emotional attachment to the game. Now, that emotional attachment requires many years, if not decades, to actually build up. You know, once you actually begin to see that you take pride in your performance of your country, once you actually begin to train your young citizens, young people, in the sport, like India has lots of people, lots of young boys, especially playing cricket, you know, and a few playing tennis. But really, you know, the investment begins to occur when you want to be like them and when you want to start playing those sports, you know, and that hasn't happened with the younger generation of Indians. It probably will in the near future, but it hasn't happened yet, you know. So the emotional investment really wasn't there in the games. And of course, the international crowd that they expected to pull in also didn't happen because of the security concerns. So, you know, which led to a fairly thin audience.
Yeah, so far we've sort of concentrated on the negative portrayal of India through the media.
Mm.
but it's really a one-sided view of the argument. And we'll sort of start to look at alternative views on contemporary India, still using the Commonwealth Games. So one of the views is that the Commonwealth Games was India's coming out party. What is meant by that statement?
I don't know if that is necessarily India's coming out party, because firstly, it didn't really come out the way China did with the Olympics. I also doubt that it's possible for a country to come out with a party when it's not in its comfort zone. You know, sport is not India's comfort zone. So I wouldn't necessarily say that that is necessarily India's coming out party. India's coming out party would probably be if it hosted the equivalent of the Cannes International Film Festival.
Mm.
You know, that would probably be India's coming out party, a real coming out party, where there would be emotional investment, every sort of investment in that sort of, you know, way arts and culture are concerned. Those are really India's very strong points. In fact, the highlight of the games as well was the closing ceremony, where the real enormous talent pool shown for, I think in my view, India's talent really in the Commonwealth Games didn't necessarily come out so much in sports, but in the opening and closing ceremonies, which were just an cultural extravaganza. You know, that's what really brought the game to its sort of zenith, as it were. So I'm not sure if I would necessarily label the games as its coming out party, given that it wasn't as successful as it could have been hoped for, even though it was one of the most expensive ones in history. But I think India's coming out party would be something where it has the resources as well as the will to host it in its own comfort zone, which I think would be more in the realm of arts and culture, in the realm of international film. You know, India, I mean, the Bollywood film industry is the popular media, popular film industry, but every state has its own indigenous film industry. Alternative media in India is absolutely brilliant, you know. Directors like Meera Nair, Satyajit Ray, they're all international names. And I think this would probably be India's coming out party more rather than, I mean, maybe in a couple of decades to come, sports might be, but I don't think sports is at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. And do you think that it's, in order to understand why the Commonwealth Games offered opportunity for India to project an image of modernisation and of diversity, the diversity that's in India, do you think it's important to understand their history and pre-colonial history and
India's pre-colonial history?
Yeah.
In order to understand the games?
Well, why, where they've come from their history to now, why they project?
I don't know. When it comes to India's history vis-a-vis sports, I would actually really point to caste as a very important indicator of India's, you know, which I think the Commonwealth Games didn't really do a good job of reflecting at all, because it was, as you said, trying to be a very modern attempt at a very modern games forum. But for example, like, you know, one of the things, which of course we never studied in the course, was that every caste played its own sport, depending on where they actually came from. Like the Brahmins would play chess, right? Because chess is a very intellectual game. You know, chess was, of course, born in India. Chess is an Indian game. So they would, you know, they would play chess because chess is a very, you know, requires you to think with the mind, etc. The Kshatriyas, the princely caste, the nobility, etc., they would engage in a lot of sword fights, wrestling. They would also play chess because chess is a game of strategy, right, which you have to be if you're fighting a war. But, you know, things like that would these are indigenous Indian sports, like wrestling or mace fighting, you know, or sword fighting. And the, you know, the lowest caste would have things like rooster fights or bull fights. Now, these are things which have been, you know, they've been banned in the interest of animal rights, etc. But a lot of indigenous sport, I don't think a single one of them was actually reflected in the Commonwealth Games. Perhaps badminton was. Badminton is sort of India's version. I don't know, India makes claims to own badminton. Hockey certainly is an Indian game. You know, hockey is certainly an Indian, born out of India, although it never became as popular as cricket in India. But Indian games never became popular in the Commonwealth Games. And that's not surprising because they were never popular in India even before that.
Yeah.
You know, it never achieved the same stage as cricket.
Yeah. So it probably wasn't a true reflection of the different diverse sports that India
No.
Has been traditionally associated with.
No. I wouldn't say. I think it's more the... I think it's all of the colonial sport, which I think the Commonwealth Games basically adapted, reflects.
Yeah.
But, you know, things like swimming. I mean, well, the thing that does show up is, like, why didn't India do better in things it could have done? India has a long peninsula coastline. We're not a nation of swimmers at all. You know, when climate change comes and the sea levels rise, we'd be scampering about for life. But we wouldn't be swimming out of it. You know, so.
So overall, did the coverage of the Games tell us about Australian perceptions of India and India culture?
Or did it reflect accurately, do you mean, Australian perceptions of India?
Yeah, well, I guess because you are now in Australia when the Games were on, did you feel that perceptions of the Commonwealth Games in India, did you think that they reflected the true nature of India?
I think in the end of the day, India did receive a lot more bad publicity than the good ones. The difference that I found was between Australian reports coming from Australia and the Australian reports coming from India. You know, the athletes' reports from India or their coaches' reports from India, they were far more positive than the reports that are coming from here. You know, when the coaches were talking about, you know, how the facilities that their athletes have or the athletes themselves were allowed to speak, they were really, really happy and satisfied with what they had. The complaints really didn't seem to come from the ones that were actually on the ground in Delhi. It was more, I mean, I think the pictures that were taken, and they were authentic pictures. They doctored pictures, but no, they were authentic pictures, much to my chagrin. They were disgusting pictures. But I think those few pictures that went around the world, they did do a lot of publicity damage. I think the spokesperson for the Commonwealth Games, the international spokesperson, he was a bit pompous, and I think he didn't go down very well with the audience because he didn't want to, you know, really, he was just giving a very politically correct party line all the time instead of really trying to get into discussions. So he was trying to play it very safe as far as the media was concerned, and that didn't go down very well either. But I think at the end of the day, I think the Games went on a lot more successfully than we actually gave it credit for. Because firstly, all the major concerns to security threats came to nothing. All the concerns with the comfort and the security of the athletes also came to nothing. So the two major concerns came to nothing. And on the contrary, the facilities that were given to them were very good, of a very, very high standard. The entire ceremony, I mean, I think it went on for 7 days from, you know, including the opening and closing. They were all very, very successful.
Amazing.
Yeah, they were very spectacular events. So I think in the end it went off well. Well, I think what, to me, what it reflects is basically the Indian psychology, where you expect that things are going to go. You know, it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy. You expect things are going to go badly, and therefore they do. But you also know that in the end, it'll be okay. You know, and this is, I speak from experience. When I heard that India won the bid for the Commonwealth Games, I thought, oh, yeah, we're going to screw up. That's what I thought, you know. I thought, yeah, we're going to screw up, and you know. But I thought we'll be okay. And that's what if a billion people think. Yeah, we're going to screw up, but we'll be okay. Well, then we'll screw up, and then we'll be okay. So I think it sort of reflected that a lot.
And just one final question. What do you think that Australians need to learn about India in order to improve relations between the two countries?
The thing is, in the last couple of years, it's only since I think early 2009, Australia has been consistently receiving a lot of bad publicity in India. I think it started with the racial attacks, the so-called racial attacks, whether they were, you know, can be truly called that or not. Then also in the Games as well, I think Australian athletes got a lot of bad publicity because they, you know, because of their drunken behavior in the end when they ended up throwing washing machines around. So I think in the end, and that as well received a lot of adverse publicity. So Australia hasn't gone down very well in Indian books at this point. India at one point even thought of issuing a travel warning, you know, when they issue a travel warning.
So it's two-way. It's not just our perceptions of India, but also India's perceptions of
Australia. And I think for a lot of 2009, there were attempts to actually, the government was thinking a lot about issuing travel warnings, saying that, you know, you are, that it is an unsafe country to travel and that sort of thing. So, but at the same time, I think I shouldn't have opened the window.
He'll fly out.
As long as it doesn't get into my hair. Yeah. No, but at the same time, I think India has actually got a... Indians in general have got a very, very positive impression of Australia as well. Always have had, except in the last 2 years. So in terms of improving relationships, I don't ever get the feeling that relationships are actually bad, that they need substantial improving. I think there's been a lot of hiccups along the way. But I've never had the impression that it's actually a bad relationship that needs to be rebuilt and there needs to be a lot of dialogue invested in it. I've never had that sort of impression about Australia and about Australian-Indian relationships. I think both countries are very important to each other because of trade, because of economic relationships. They're both really growing, increasingly important trading partners. And, you know, businesses are not going to let that come in the way. So I wouldn't imagine that there's actually... there's a lot of research collaborations I can see in almost every area, whether it's science or social sciences or environmental studies. There's a lot of research collaborations. So I think there are hiccups along the way, and but I think it's more of more annoying rather than serious.
Mm. And I think probably everyday Australians or everyday Indians probably don't realise how important the relationship is between Australia and India, as you said in those points, to do with trade and that sort of thing. They probably don't understand how much they rely on each other for those.
Yeah, absolutely. And also the Indian community in Australia is a very young community relatively as compared to Indian communities in the United States or in the Gulf or in the UK. They're very established communities. They've been around for a very, very long time. And in India and in Australia, they're comparatively much younger. Now, I think it's teething troubles to that extent. Because the thing is, if you look at Indian communities elsewhere in the world, they are actually one of the most model immigrant communities. They're the highest tax-paying communities. They're the wealthiest communities. So you want wealthy immigrants rather than immigrants that are living off the dole, you know? So that's actually more important for a country's economic health. Now, that's always been the case in the UK, in the US, in the Gulf, etc. Now, they've been economically productive citizens. And I think that is increasingly the case in Australia as well. They managed to, you know, the medical profession, in many parts of Australia, what 40% of the medical professionals are Indians. So I think a lot of this is actually teething troubles. But going by Indian history, Indian immigrant history elsewhere, I don't see that this will be a problem in the long-term future, hopefully.
Thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you very much for the questions. They're really well-worded, reflective questions.